Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Parents rely on safe, affordable child care so they can go to work. In the last 10 years, the state has experienced a dramatic decline in the number of home-based family care providers. Legislation now winding its way through the Kentucky General Assembly aims to change that, and we're joined to talk about it by Becky Stacy, Administration and Advocacy Director at the Appalachian Early Childhood Network based in Hazard. Becky, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So Senate Bill 148, sponsored by Republican State Senator Danny Carroll from Benton, Kentucky, what would it do?
So this bill is basically asking for zoning regulations to be eased for family child care homes. We feel that they aren't the same as other businesses in neighborhoods. There's not going to be traffic issues or parking issues and those kinds of things. But typically, family child care homes have been looked at in the same way as other businesses. So this bill would actually ease, or at least it's a good first step in easing some of those zoning regulations that inhibit family child care homes.
And are those regulations and those kind of barriers, are they a main reason that there's been such a steep decline in home-based child care in Kentucky?
That is certainly one of the reasons, especially in the urban areas where people have not been allowed to open these family child care homes because of such regulations. There are, of course, other reasons, but this has been a major barrier for people in the urban areas especially.
Well, let's talk about the need. I've heard it said that about 50% of Kentuckians are now living in what could be described as a child care desert. Tell us about that.
Yes. So in Kentucky, approximately 50% of the state is a child care desert. We see that family child care homes would help fill that need because these types of providers can be within your neighborhood. In areas such as my area in eastern Kentucky, we have parents who have to drive such far distances to get to child care. That sometimes they aren't able to afford it, to be honest. And so we think that when we look at family child care homes, we can put those businesses right in the middle of the neighborhoods where that parents have access, have very easy access to child care.
And who would you say is hit hardest by this lack of child care?
Well, and especially during COVID, with the parents I've have spoken to, working women have just, their numbers are just decreasing day by day. I believe in January, there was a huge decrease. 275,000 women left the workforce in January. So it's definitely hitting women harder and women of color, especially.
The Kentucky Child Care Survey, Continuing Impact of COVID-19 Pandemic on Parents and Families, was launched back in May of 2020 to gather information about the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on child care providers, parents, and families. And there have been several of these surveys over the year. Can you tell us what some of the highlights are from those surveys?
Yes. So one of the big findings is that parents cannot afford child care. Mm-hmm. The parents are finding it harder to qualify for any assistance for paying for their child care. And so many times parents are not able to work because of that. We've seen parents who have had to quit well-paying jobs because they don't qualify for child care help. So that was one of the big issues that we saw was being able to afford it. And of course, during COVID, we had many centers and family child care homes that were shut down. And very few were open for first responders and essential employees. And so there were lots of child care spots that were lost during the pandemic.
Hmm. You've already mentioned that Senate Bill 148 focuses primarily on the zoning issue. But I'm wondering, are there certain protections, certain standards that have to be met, or are they needed for residential child care to be safe for children?
Yeah, of course. But I think that our licensing for family child care homes is already quite strict, and it has regulations that make sure that these family child care homes are safe. Within neighborhoods, I think that a worry has been, in-home businesses may cause traffic problems, or there may be signs or things like that that are put up in the neighborhood. But a family child care home is not going to be the same as another business. And so I think that the regulations that we have in licensing already provide for that. We just need these zoning regulations to ease up a little so that family child care providers are able to open. And we want to make sure that neighborhoods and communities see this as a plus for their area.
Is there a limit on the number of children that can be taken in a residential child care center?
A certified family child care home can have up to 6 unrelated children and up to 4 children who are related to the provider.
Becky, this bill is before the House. Do you have any sense of what sort of reception it's receiving in the House of Representatives in Frankfurt?
I feel like that... luckily, COVID, the one good thing that's come out of it is COVID has caused a lot of lawmakers to see how important child care is. And so I feel very positive about it. And I think that in the coming months and years, hopefully we will see more push toward supporting these family homes and even, supporting it as a business, especially for working mothers who have lost their jobs or had to leave their jobs because of childcare. So I do get a sense that it's very positive in Frankfurt and that we're going to see good things come from this bill.
This could be seen in the context of a jobs program, actually, because the lack of care is keeping people out of jobs.
Absolutely. And we're hoping that lawmakers will begin to see this as a way to build the economy if we can support these new businesses and allow mothers to work at home while caring for their own children and having a career.
Okay, that's Becky Stacy, Administration and Advocacy Director at the Appalachian Early Childhood Network in Hazard. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
What kind of courage does it take to lead a school or a school district in these very difficult times? And how does courage play into our everyday lives as citizens of a democracy? In the latest in his series on the virtues of a democratic society, Jim Trimble looks into this with Dr. Kathy Lassiter, consultant and educator and author of Everyday Courage for School Leaders.
Kathy Lassiter, when we use the term courage or hero, at least in American society, we tend to imagine heroic acts by extraordinary humans in the face of danger or fear. We think of soldiers or first responders, athletes even. But you have a different take on the typical idea of courage.
So yes, absolutely. I have a different take on courage, and it's based on research that has been done mainly in the last 20 years on courage and what courage means and can you activate courage and can you leverage courage in an organization for organizational performance. That's really why I started looking at it. And what I found historically, actually, is that Plato was the very first one to liken courage to a type of perseverance. And he tied courage to everyday challenges, like being sick or, having family issues and those kinds of things. And so over these many hundreds of years, the idea of courage has evolved for some to really be, courage of moral courage and empathetic courage, having disciplined courage. And these are the kinds of things that I wrote about in my book that I thought were really very relevant to school leaders in today's society.
As an educator, you've been, a teacher, middle school principal, author, consultant. You take the idea of courage and apply it to schools and educators. How does that work?
Yeah, so it is applied to them because for many years, and I've been in education 35, 36 years, and, you know, done a lot of leadership work. As you said, I was a principal, I was a district office administrator, and watching the everyday courage that our school principals across this country exhibit led me to thinking about what is the role of courage when it comes to effective school leadership, and what are some of those challenges and things that keep school leaders up at night, to be quite frank with you, and why is it that some of them are able to be steadfast in their beliefs on what's right for children and stand in the face of sometimes some pretty stiff opposition, either politically or from parents or even from their own district offices, and others buckle under that kind of pressure. And I wanted to write a book that might be helpful to school leaders to understand the impact of having courage as a leader and the impact of not having courage as a leader, and how that impacts the performance of staff and how it impacts the performance of students and the satisfaction of parents who are served by a school.
I would imagine that this is being brought to the forefront 100-fold during this global pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, the field of education completely was upended overnight, basically. I remember I was in Toledo working with a group of leaders there on March 13th. I don't think this date will ever leave my head. I left that session, got to the airport, and was my phone was just blowing up with colleagues and clients calling to say we were now a virtual profession, and that schools were not going back, and that teachers were going to teach online, and leaders were going to have to help teachers teach online. And that kind of sudden and significant change sent everybody into a tailspin. And the courage to make mistakes, to, you know, admit, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to reach kids online. I don't know how to teach on a computer, was significant. And we're still dealing with it. But I have to say that in the opening of school this year, it's remarkable what has been learned and what is being done to constantly reach out to children to try to provide them the best education we can in a totally new and different way.
How does courage also affect students? I mean, they have stepped up against so many odds during this time of the pandemic to learn a new way of learning and interacting with their fellow students and teachers using digital formats and things like that. What kind of courage have we seen from students?
Well, I tell you, we have seen great courage from students, and they're so resilient. Young people have resilience beyond measure, I think, sometimes, and they're willing to try and take the lead of an adult who is nurturing and is welcoming and is supportive and respectful of a child and the challenges that they bring to the situation. And I'll add another component to your discussion, the courage of parents. You know, like never before, we always say parent is the first teacher, you know, but parent is like the only teacher right now for some of these kids. And parents are not used to having children at home and monitoring their learning so closely and having to be the technology person in the home so that students can access their learning. And so we've seen tremendous courage on the part of parents. And I will say tremendous determination on the part of parents to gain access for their children to technology that they heretofore have not had. You know, really advocating for their kids and saying, well, my child doesn't have internet at home. My child doesn't have a computer, you know, and really going the extra mile to make sure that their students have the resources they need at home and to do all that they can while working from home or while being an essential worker and having to be out of the home to support the students learning who is at home. And so parents have their whole world upended as well with this.
You talk about four types of, and the phrase everyday courage. It's so much different than the original image that I started our conversation with, you know, kind of a superhero. Yeah. But you talk about moral courage, intellectual, disciplined, and empathetic. Talk about moral courage, everyday courage for a normal person in a democratic society like the United States?
Yes. It's really those core values you hold as a person. What is it? What are those values that drive who you are as a human being? It drives who you are as a parent, as an employee of someone's organization, you know, as a member of your church, as a coach in the Little League. What are those core values that drive who you are and that you really steady you as a person in life? And so moral courage is when those core values are challenged by something or someone, and having the courage to stick to those values that you hold dear. And typically that is, they are values for the greater good of the community, right? Like, this is what we're doing to an individual or a group of people is not right. It is a violation of rights. You know, when people are treated unfairly or disrespectfully, you know, we hold to that and we don't turn a blind eye to it. We act by speaking up or joining organizations or protesting even to make our views be known.
What about intellectual courage?
Yeah, so that's a good one. So intellectual courage, in the school sense, it encourages principals and teachers to stay current in what the evidence shows us works best for young people. And, you know, education has been done the same way for many, many years. And so it really means that we recognize the limitations of our own thinking and are open to new ideas based on research and evidence, and that we take that and re-examine our current understandings to maybe learn and know things in a different way, and to recognize practices that we have in place that are based on old thinking and that new evidence shows are not so effective, and having the courage to change it.
What about disciplined courage?
Disciplined courage is where we have an opportunity to initiate a change or to push an idea, that we don't give up on it so quickly when we are faced with opposition, right? That you remain steadfast and strategic in the way that you're thinking, that you are disciplined in bringing on a change that you know is for the greater good, and you don't let an early setback or voices in opposition shut you down. I quoted an author, his name's Mike Staber, and he wrote a book called Leadership Isn't for Cowards, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And he said that disciplined courage is really around clarity of beliefs and mindfulness in your execution. Like, it's not that you're not listening to others, you are, but you're finding a way to navigate to a new understanding and to be disciplined in that approach so that you can endure, that you're flexible and you're enduring, but you don't give up on ideas and changes that you know are needed just, you know, because people don't agree with you.
How do you activate courage?
There's a ton of research, neurological research out there on courage. And so what I looked at was research that was done at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. And it's pretty recent research. And what these neuroscientists did was, in order to measure courage in the brain, they have to put people in a fear-induced situation, right? So long story short, they put people in an MRI machine, and they also put snakes in the MRI machine. And as you're in the MRI machine, the machine is measuring all your brain activity. And they had people in there who weren't afraid of snakes, and they had people who were deathly afraid of snakes. And you could push a button to advance the snake closer to you, and it was on the, like, this little platform. It wasn't in a cage or a box or anything. Or you could push a button and retreat the snake so it will go further away from you. So what they did was measure the brain activity for people who are really afraid of snakes and who had previously in a survey said they were deathly afraid. They measured palm sweating, they measured heart rate, all of these things that happen when people are afraid. Long story short, they found that there is a courage center in the brain. It's way deep in the center of the brain between, you know, your eyes and your ears. And people who were afraid and yet pushed advance for the snakes, the snake was coming closer and closer, they could see this courage center in the brain light up. And what their conclusion was is that every human being has this courage center, and they can activate courage if they mindfully decide to do it. And that the more you activate your courage, the less you need it, because you're becoming more and more accustomed to that particular situation. And so it doesn't require courage anymore after you activate it.
So you are changing. You are becoming something new.
Yes.
Kathy Lassiter, thank you so much for our conversation today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Kathy Lassiter is an educator, author, consultant who divides her time between Virginia and Florida. Thank you again.
That's Jim Trimble with the latest in his Eastern Standard series about the virtues of a democratic society. Coming up after the break, is COVID-19 just a bad flu? Ask a COVID long hauler, and here's what they'll tell you.
It's not just a bad flu. We don't know what the long-term impacts of COVID are. I it's possible I might never regain my smell and taste.
Kentucky cellist, singer, and composer Ben Solly on his continuing experience with COVID-19 and all about his soundtrack for the new Robin Wright film, Land. And fellow Kentucky cellist Cecilia Wright is out with her first album. We'll hear all about it. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, Josephine Sculpture Park in Frankfort will host its monthly First Sunday Nature Tour, 1 to 2 p.m. March 7th. Registration is required. For more information and to register, visit the park's website, josephinesculpturepark.org. Art Center of the Bluegrass in Danville is hosting the exhibit, The Art of Being Black, through April 17th. The exhibit features the work of several black artists from around Kentucky. For more information, visit the center's website, artcenterky.org. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Word of another arts event hit our inbox after Tom Musgrave sent in the arts calendar for this edition. The Lexington-based organization Arts Connect is doing a Zoom for an artist reception and talk around the topic, Gimme Shelter. 18 local and regional artists now exhibiting their work in the Arts Connect Arts Space Virtual Gallery will be discussing those works. If you're listening to us before our Sunday evening rebroadcast, you can sign up to join this conversation, which will be happening at 4 p.m. on Sunday, March 7th, by going online to artsconnectlex.org. That's one word, artsconnectlex.org. I've experienced a lot of soul-stirring performances by our next guest, so it was pretty unsettling recently to spot a Facebook post by Kentucky cellist, singer, and composer Ben Solly, letting us know that he is a COVID-19 long hauler. And this has been happening just as his latest body of music was being released. Ben Solly, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we're going to talk with you about your soundtrack for the movie Land in just a moment. But first, tell us about this experience you've been having with COVID-19.
Well, I think there's a body of knowledge and community starting to form around these long-term COVID symptoms. I guess what Fauci is calling the acute post-COVID syndrome. And, it's really just folks who had, fairly serious or even mild case of COVID that are having ongoing symptoms for months and sometimes even, the full year since they've had it. And, for me, that manifests as, I still don't have smell and taste. There's still quite a bit of brain fog up there, dizziness and fatigue. And really it's kind of means that, myself and a lot of others that are going through this are kind of having to adjust to a new normal within the new normal, right? So we're all having to live differently in pandemic times and lockdown. And then within that lockdown, you're kind of learning how to work within your new boundaries that have been given to you by this long-term syndrome.
And you came down with this in November. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Yeah. It made its way into our home and right around Halloween. And then everybody got it.
Your whole household did?
Yeah. So it's my wife and I and our three children, including our little baby.
Oh, my.
So it was definitely a really challenging time. As any parent listening knows, being sick while taking care of sick kids is just one of the most grueling things you can do.
I'm shaking my head here.
you're right about that.
So is everybody okay now?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody's doing all right. Everybody else is fully recovered. I'm the only one that has persistent symptoms.
Huh. Well, do you have a message, Ben, for anybody who's still, after all this time, and they're out there, unconvinced about the dangers posed by this coronavirus?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a challenging one to answer, because what we're really talking about is, you know, people's faith and systems and belief. And there's a lot of people that have, you know, good reasons personally and anecdotally through their communities, you know, to be skeptical of, you know, scientists and medicine. But at the end of the day, this virus is absolutely real, as we know from the staggering death toll. And then knowing that it's real, understanding that you have the power to help others. And it's not just a bad flu. We don't know what the long-term impacts of COVID are. It's possible I might never regain my smell and taste. That's a possibility.
Wow.
It's possible that I might have ongoing autoimmune issues. You know, and we were very careful. We had decided to let our son go to school, and the school had set up, you know, smaller pods, and it made contact tracing very easy, but it didn't protect us. You can be careful, or even if you're not careful about it, you can catch this, and you just don't quite know what the results are going to be.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear that you all have gone through this. Would you say that has music been helpful to you during this?
Well, music is something I've been doing for such a long time. It's part of the family environment that I grew up in, with a mom and dad who both loved and performed music, a grandfather who was an old-time musician, played fiddle and sang. And so it's kind of home base for me, but certainly in my career as a cellist and composer, it is the thing I've been doing for the longest period of time in my life. So there's a sort of grounding effect that happens when I sit down to play cello. It feels like home. It feels like something that I know quite well, and honestly probably helped me understand that I was having ongoing symptoms when I would sit down to play cello and it didn't feel like I remembered it feeling. And I know that that's a special thing. You know, there's some folks that have so much instability in their lives that it's hard to feel when things have changed, especially folks that are struggling with income and living on the poverty line, or maybe even on the other side of it, that are just kind of workaholics and just go. There's not enough stability in their lives to realize when something is not right. I think that that's one of the messages that I would share too, is to just kind of like pause, listen to your body. If you still don't feel like you're able to do quite as much as you did before, and you still don't feel like you're as sharp thinking wise as you were before, or that you're as creative or whatever, just give yourself a little grace, because it might be connected to having COVID, or it might just be connected to the environment that we're in right now, which is super unstable feeling. So, yeah, give yourself a little grace. I really beat myself up because I wasn't feeling as productive. I wasn't feeling as creative. I wasn't feeling like I could do as much with my kids. Like, I just really beat myself up there for a little bit. And it was really reaching out to the community on social media, and having everybody be like, hey, just take the time that you need. And, oh, by the way, here's some ideas on how to help yourself feel better.
Well, listening to your latest work, the soundtrack of the film Land, which was directed by and stars Robin Wright, I got to tell you, Ben, it's a pretty transcendent experience listening to that. And to give our listeners a sense of what I'm talking about, let's listen to a passage. Out of the 20 tracks, what should I play here?
Let's play, in context of our conversation, I think it's appropriate to listen to Healing Part 1. This is a track that accompanies a moment in the movie where Robin Wright's character, Edie, is coming out of a long period of really challenging experiences surviving on a mountain in Wyoming by herself through a winter. And it is just an inkling of her not only physically starting to come into her own and learning how to care for herself in that space, but also emotionally and mentally starting to come out of her shell. And you can kind of hear it in the music, which starts in a very hesitant kind of walking, stumbling pace, and then kind of finds its footing and then expands with the ensemble with higher, you know, more sweeping sounds. You know, the ensemble for this film was really rooted in a string ensemble called Time for Three, which is based in the Northeast. It's a double fiddle and bass trio. You know, Robin, the director, had attended one of their shows up in New York and loved what they did. So when I was hired as the composer on the project, she asked me to kind of compose for them as an ensemble. What we didn't know when we signed on is that we would be composing this thing during a pandemic. And so we really kind of focused on the palette of instruments that we all had in our home studios to try to achieve these sounds. So as you listen to the track, you can really kind of hear everybody leaning into all the different ways they play the instruments.
Well, of course, this is not your first soundtrack. There was Maiden Trip, Beauty Mark, but I'm wondering, how did Robin Wright find you?
Yeah, so this is a wonderful grassroots stories, right? So I guess Robin, you know, years ago was going through an experience in her life that was trying, and a friend made a mixtape, which probably looked like a burned CD for them, for her. Uh-huh. And on that CD was a song of mine called Prettiest Tree on the Mountain, which is a song, you know, of and about Kentucky and our beautiful natural landscape and, you know, the beautiful humans that come out of it.
Well, a robin flew by my window. I thought it just might be you. Judged from the color of its breast and the sound of its song, but I'm just thinking of you. 'Cause you're in sunny California, the fertile land, John Steinbeck Road. Oh, but when I came, not a single fertile patch could be spared for you and me. You see, I wanted to love you, baby, like neither you nor I've been loved before. I thought I could change the world if I just held you high enough. Truth is, I couldn't hold you up at all. Couldn't hold you.
She was a fan from that, and then the music supervisor on the movie had heard a track of mine called Embrace and sent it to Robin, and Robin found it really fitting for the movie.
If ever your hand should tremble, if ever your heart should
that's how I got the call. And then after some back and forth and sending some demos to Robin, I got the gig to make music for this. And as you mentioned, this is her directorial debut. Fans of Robin Wright, you know, love her from her performances in Princess Bride and Forrest Gump and all the way up through House of Cards and Wonder Woman. But this is the first time that she's been in the director's chair for a feature length film. And as part of that process, we all learned, you know, with her and together, you know, what this film needed and how to get it accomplished, you know, regardless of the pandemic.
So how do you go about that? How do you go about composing tracks to fit the moods and the action on the screen? And is that a collaborative process?
Well, in past films where I was the sole composer on a film, you know, it's very much a process where you work with the director, any producers that are involved creatively, and certainly the editors and music supervisors. Step one is to get a film that is what they call picture locked. So you get a cut of the movie that is as long as it's going to be, and the scenes are edited the way that they're going to be. There might be some placeholder footage in there, but that's pretty much how it's going to sit. And then everybody gets together, typically in person, and you do what's called a spotting session, where everybody watches through all of the different scenes and focuses on ones that have music in them, which are called cues. And they discuss what the purpose of the music is in that scene, what themes it has and connects to in other parts of the movie, what the underlying emotional need is. And sometimes that can be something that's really up for discussion. The director might feel that a theme is really overcoming and uplifting and heroic, while somebody else might feel like it's battered and beaten down. And so you have a discussion like, where do we meet in the middle on that? And then you take all those spotting notes, which are substantial often, and you start composing little pieces of music and demos for it, if you haven't already. And then it's just an iterative process, and often a process of attrition, right? You make a lot of material and then you whittle it down to the stuff that the film needs. At the end of the day, the film tells you what it needs, but it does take a lot of music and a lot of time to find that.
Well, we just have a little bit of time left, and I wanted to bring it around to something that you mentioned earlier in our conversation about sitting down with the cello and how it feels to you. And this is a tough question for any artist, I think, because their instrument becomes part of them. But I wonder, can you tell me why the cello feels right for you?
Well, the cello is a very special instrument. You know, I'm sure most of your listeners know what it looks like, but just to describe it, it's, you know, it's like a large violin, and you sit with it, you play it seated typically, and it's leaned against your body, and it has four strings, and, you know, the lower strings are quite resonant. And the instrument, because it's leaned against your body and you're kind of wrapped around it, really resonates against your body. I mean, it's, you know, you can literally feel it resting against your sternum vibrating when you play it. So there's a really special connection with the instrument. And because of that, you can feel when the instrument is not well, when the wood has cracked or separated in some spot, or when the strings have gotten old and lost their resonance, or maybe the bridge has moved, isn't in the right place. You can also feel when your body is not aligned, because this is a wooden box with strings and, you know, a neck. And while it changes a little bit, the body is different every day you wake up. So when you sit down with the instrument, it's an opportunity to realign and kind of listen to yourself and understand what's changed today, what's a little bit different today. And often that's something that you just kind of tweak and get back to. But when I sit down with the instrument post-COVID, it really felt different, and there were territories of the cello that felt foreign for the first time in a long time, and there were parts of my body that felt unbalanced, you know, and that told me a lot about it. And, you know, for some people that might be cooking, You know, they might be able to not spice things correctly anymore. Or some people might be woodworkers and, you know, the weight of the wood might feel off to them. Whatever that thing is that you do in your life consistently is a really great way to kind of measure when you're getting back to your normal.
And where are you now, would you say? How do you feel about it now?
I'm in a place that I've been in for the last 3 months, where, you know, specifically the right side of my body feels heavier than the left side of my body. The cello, you know, reaching across the cello, playing on the high side, often I find myself, you know, pressing too hard, which means that I'm not really connected to the string. So I just feel a little bit disoriented on the cello. I overcome that often by playing along with a drone. So that can be, you know, a sound that is recorded that has just one single tone to it. And playing the cello with that and really sinking into getting my center of pitch together, making sure that my bow draws across the strings consistently, making sure that I can play and sing along to the cello in a way that matches the timbre of the instrument. And once I do that for about 15 or 20 minutes, I start to feel normal again.
Well, in just a moment, we're going to hear from another cellist who told me to say hi to you, and that's Cecilia Wright here in Lexington. She's just out with her. Just coming out with her debut album. So we're going to hear about that in a moment. But what about you? What's next for you, Ben Sully?
Well, I'm working on a couple other film and TV projects. One that you and your listeners might find interesting, about universal basic income, called Bootstraps. We put 12 people on universal basic income for 2 years and filmed it. So that's going to be a really cool project that I'll let you know when there's more info out about that.
Please do.
Yeah. And then I am working with Kentucky Performing Arts on a holiday show that hopefully we'll be able to celebrate together. And then more sooner, in the next couple of weeks, I'll have a recording out called Slow Flow. That is a cello improv that I did in a grain silo that sounds absolutely, you know, sonorous and glorious, that I've edited down so that it can accompany whatever activity you would like, you know, whether it's yoga or cooking or a walk. It's just meant to really accompany a daily activity, a slow flow, try to get recentered.
Well, for somebody who is describing himself as having slowed down, it doesn't sound like you slowed down very much. You're very busy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am definitely a compulsive creative, which is to say I like doing a lot of things. And, you know, you know from our discussions in the past, I work with a nonprofit called Canopy, helping businesses incorporate a social environmental mission.
Right.
I've also done a bunch of different work with different clients around storytelling. So I do love doing this work. I just have to be really intentional about what I'm working on now,
right,
which is not entirely a bad thing.
Cellist, vocalist, composer Ben Sully, always a pleasure to talk to you, Ben. And we thank you for your time and also speedy recovery.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And as promised, we're joined now from Lexington by cellist, bassist, vocalist, songwriter, and now recording artist, Cecilia Wright, to talk about her debut album, Another Human. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, Tom.
So you have just come out with an album. Is this your first?
Yes, this is my first solo project. All of songs that I wrote, I've played cello on a lot of other records, but this is the first project that's really all mine.
Well, I want to dig into it in just a second, but let's go over some of those other projects that you've worked on. Tell us about some of the recordings you've done.
Yeah, so I spent a long time in Knoxville playing with the Lone Tones, and here in town in Lexington, I've played a lot with Warren Byram, and recently recorded a record with my husband with Bear Medicine. And this past year also recorded with Sonora May, who just released a record, and with Tyler Childers.
So you just released your own new solo album, Another Human, 8 songs on this album. Are these pieces that you've been writing over time and saving for this project, or do they connect in some way?
Yeah, most of the songs, I think all of the songs I wrote over the past 2 years, and I didn't really have a plan to put together an entire record, but when the songs started to feel like a collection and everything got shut down in the pandemic and we weren't able to perform, it was just kind of tempting to get in the studio and put them together and see what happened. So it was a little bit of an experiment, but it ended up being really cathartic and really a fun project to connect with my friends and some family members. And so it kind of happened very organically and unexpectedly.
Well, let's give our listeners an opportunity to kind of sample some of the work from your album. Is there a particular tune that you would like for me to play, maybe a verse of?
Yeah, let's try a little bit of Make You Happy.
Okay, let's listen.
If I was a constellation in the midnight sky,
that's Cecilia Wright, Make You Happy, from her new album, Another Human. And who's featured on that track?
That is Warren Byram, who lives here in Lexington, who I play a lot of music with as well.
Well, you've pulled together a lot of players, familiar to many who know the Lexington music scene here. You want to give a shout out to those folks?
Yeah. So Robbie Cosenza's on drums, and my husband, Joshua Wright, is playing guitar. Otto Helmuth recorded, and he sang a little bit. We've got Warren Byram, Caroline Copley singing a lot of harmonies. My cousin, Forrest Winsel in Knoxville, played all the piano parts. We've got Mason Colby on banjo, Nora Veblen on clarinet, and in New York, vibraphonist Derek Dickens.
So that's a lot of cats to herd together, and I don't know if people really realize that, you know, that goes on. It takes a lot of organization. What was that like for you?
Well, it was fun because, you know, I started just with Josh and Robbie, and the three of us got together and kind of just rehearsed the kind of bare bones, the instrumental parts, and got in the studio and recorded all of that live. And then it was just a process of kind of adding other parts. And I had some ideas of the instrumentation I wanted, and then some of it was a little bit of an experiment. So that was fun to kind of just lay down the basic instrumental parts and then kind of figure out what would make sense and what would be fun to add to it.
Is cello your principal instrument?
Yeah.
Because there's something about the instrument. There are a few instruments that I think share the quality that I'm about to talk about, and that is the human voice. I would put the violin in that category, the tenor saxophone, perhaps, maybe clarinet. But the cello is really, to me, evocative of the human vocal timbre and quality. Do you hear that in it when you're playing it?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's a combination of the tone, but also the range of the instrument. You know, it occupies a space in the bass range, but also goes into treble clef. So, you know, it's really the range of a human voice as well. And it's a fun instrument to play with songwriters because I spend a lot of time kind of trying to imitate the voice or following the line, the vocal parts, and either coming up with a harmony that kind of mimics a voice or something that complements what the singer is doing.
Cecilia, I spotted you on Facebook as that February snowstorm was heading our way, and you were saying that you'd be spending the day, we were all kind of hunkered down, you were going to spend your day learning to sing while playing bass. How did that work out?
Well, I spent a little bit of time doing it, and then I plugged my amp into an outlet that I think was no good, and my amp started smoking. That kind of put a stop to that yesterday, but it seems to be working again today, so I might spend some time again doing that today.
Yeah, that's a good time to stop, I think. So you must be really excited now that this album is done, it's out, you've got the artwork, and everything is done. It's been released. It must be an enormous release and relief for you.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it was such a meaningful project to me because I've spent so many years being more of a supportive role for other songwriters. And so to be really in charge of this project was really fun and really empowering. And and I put a lot of emotion to it and I was able to connect with, really close friends. And even my best friend in Houston did the album art, and it was just fun to have a project to work on together because we haven't been able to see each other in such a long time. So, yeah, it was really special for a lot of different reasons.
Okay, well, let's let everybody know where they can find it.
Yeah, so you can find Another Human on all of the streaming platforms, Spotify, iTunes, all of that good stuff. And then you can also purchase a digital download or purchase a CD on Bandcamp.
That's cellist, bassist, vocalist, songwriter, and recording artist Cecilia Wright, and she joined us from Lexington. Thanks, Cecilia.
Thank you.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. People who make this happen: Mike Savage, our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.